The Secrets of the Princess de Cadignan. Chapter 1. The Last Word of Two Great Coquettes. After the disasters of the Revolution of July, which destroyed so many aristocratic fortunes dependent on the court, Madame la Princesse de Cadignan was clever enough to attribute to political events the total ruin she had caused by her own extravagance. The prince left France with the royal family, and never returned to it, leaving the princess in Paris, protected by the fact of his absence, for their debts, which the sale of all their saleable property had not been able to extinguish, could only be recovered through him. The revenues of the entailed estates had been seized. In short, the affairs of this great family were in as bad a state as those of the elder branch of the Bourbons. This woman, so celebrated under her first name of Duchesse de Maufrigneuse, very wisely decided to live in retirement, and to make herself, if possible, forgotten. Paris was then so carried away by the whirling current of events that the Duchesse de Maufrigneuse, buried in the Princesse de Cadignan, a change of name unknown to most of the new actors brought upon the stage of society by the Revolution of July, did really become a stranger in her own city. In Paris the title of Duke ranks all others, even that of Prince, though, in heraldic theory, free of all sophism, titles signify nothing, there is absolute equality among gentlemen. This fine equality was formerly maintained by the House of France itself, and in our day it is so still, at least, nominally, witness the care with which the kings of France give to their sons the simple title of Count. It was in virtue of this system that François I crushed the splendid titles assumed by the pompous Charles V, by signing his answer, François, Seigneur de Vannes. Louis XI did better still by marrying his daughter to an untitled gentleman, Pierre de Beaujeu. The feudal system was so thoroughly broken up by Louis XIV that the title of Duke became, during his reign, the supreme honor of the aristocracy, and the most coveted. Nevertheless, there are two or three families in France in which the principality, richly endowed in former times, takes precedence of the duchy. The House of Cadignan, which possesses the title of Duc de Maufrigneuse for its eldest sons, is one of these exceptional families. Like the princes of the House of Rohan in earlier days, the princes of Cadignan had the right to a throne in their own domain, they could have pages and gentlemen in their service. This explanation is necessary, as much to escape foolish critics who know nothing, as to record the customs of a world which, we are told, is about to disappear, and which, evidently, so many persons are assisting to push away without knowing what it is. The Cadignans bear, or, five lozenges sable appointed, placed fesswise, with the word Memini for motto, a crown with a cap of maintenance, no supporters or mantle. In these days the great crowd of strangers flocking to Paris, and the almost universal ignorance of the science of heraldry, are beginning to bring the title of prince into fashion. There are no real princes but those possessed of principalities, to whom belongs the title of highness. The disdain shown by the French nobility for the title of prince, and the reasons which caused Louis XIV to give supremacy to the title of duke, have prevented Frenchmen from claiming the appellation of highness for the few princes who exist in France, those of Napoleon excepted. This is why the princes of Cadignan hold an inferior position, nominally, to the princes of the continent. The members of the society called the Faubourg Saint-Germain protected the princess by a respectful silence due to her name, which is one of those that all men honor, to her misfortunes, which they cease to discuss, and to her beauty, the only thing she saved of her departed opulence. Society, of which she had once been the ornament, was thankful to her for having, as it were, taken the veil, and cloistered herself in her own home. This act of good taste was for her, more than for any other woman, an immense sacrifice. Great deeds are always so keenly felt in France that the princess gained, by her retreat, as much as she had lost in public opinion in the days of her splendor. She now saw only one of her old friends, the Marquise d'Espard, and even to her she never went on festive occasions or to parties. The princess and the marquise visited each other in the forenoons, with a certain amount of secrecy. When the princess went to dine with her friend, the marquise closed her doors. Madame d'Espard treated the princess charmingly, she changed her box at the opera, leaving the first tier for a baignoire on the ground floor, so that Madame de Cadignan could come to the theatre unseen, and depart incognito. Few women would have been capable of a delicacy which deprived them of the pleasure of bearing in their train a fallen rival, and of publicly being her benefactress. Thus relieved of the necessity for costly toilets, the princess could enjoy the theatre, whither she went in Madame d'Espard's carriage, which she would never have accepted openly in the daytime. No one has ever known Madame d'Espard's reasons for behaving thus to the Princesse de Cadignan, but her conduct was admirable, and for a long time included a number of little acts which, viewed single, seem mere trifles, but taken in the mass become gigantic. In 1832, 3 years had thrown a mantle of snow over the follies and adventures of the Duchesse de Maufrigneuse, and had whitened them so thoroughly that it now required a serious effort of memory to recall them. Of the queen once adored by so many courtiers, and whose follies might have given a theme to a variety of novels, there remained a woman still adorably beautiful, 36 years of age, but quite justified in calling herself 30, although she was the mother of Duc Georges de Maufrigneuse, a young man of 18, handsome as Antinous, poor as Job, who was expected to obtain great successes, and for whom his mother desired, above all things, to find a rich wife. Perhaps this hope was the secret of the intimacy she still kept up with the Marquise, in whose salon, which was one of the first in Paris, she might eventually be able to choose among many heiresses for George's wife. The princess saw 5 years between the present moment and her son's marriage, 5 solitary and desolate years, for, in order to obtain such a marriage for her son, she knew that her own conduct must be marked in the corner with discretion. The princess lived in the Rue de Miromesnil, in a small house, of which she occupied the ground floor at a moderate rent. There she made the most of the relics of her past magnificence. The elegance of the great lady was still redolent about her. She was still surrounded by beautiful things which recalled her former existence. On her chimney-piece was a fine miniature portrait of Charles X, by Madame Mirabel, beneath which were engraved the words, given by the king, and, as a pendant, the portrait of Madame, who was always her kind friend. On a table lay an album of costliest price, such as none of the burgesses who now lord it in our industrial and fault-finding society would have dared to exhibit. This album contained portraits, about 30 in number, of her intimate friends, whom the world, first and last, had given her as lovers. The number was a calumny, but had rumor said 10, it might have been, as her friend Madame Despard remarked, good, sound gossip. The portraits of Maxime de Trelles, de Marsay, Rastignac, the Marquis d'Escrignon, General Montriveau, the Marquis de Ronquerolles and de Giudipinto, Prince Galathion, the young Dukes de Grandlieu and de Retore, the Vicomte de Serizy, and the handsome Lucien de Rubempré, had all been treated with the utmost coquetry of brush and pencil by celebrated artists. As the princess now received only 2 or 3 of these personages, she called the book, jokingly, the collection of her errors. Misfortune had made this woman a good mother. During the 15 years of the Restoration she had amused herself far too much to think of her son, but on taking refuge in obscurity, this illustrious egoist bethought her that the maternal sentiment, developed to its extreme, might be an absolution for her past follies in the eyes of sensible persons, who pardon everything to a good mother. She loved her son all the more because she had nothing else to love. Georges de Maufrigneuse was, moreover, one of those children who flatter the vanities of a mother, and the princess had, accordingly, made all sorts of sacrifices for him. She hired a stable and coach house, above which he lived in a little entresol with 3 rooms looking on the street, and charmingly furnished. She had even borne several privations to keep a saddle horse, a cab horse, and a little groom for his use. For herself, she had only her own maid, and as cook, a former kitchen maid. The Duke's groom had, therefore, rather a hard place. Toby, formerly Tiger to the late Boudet Nord, such was the jesting term applied by the gay world to that ruined gentleman, Toby, who at 25 years of age was still considered only 14, was expected to groom the horses, clean the cabriolet, or the tilbury, and the harnesses, accompany his master, take care of the apartments, and be in the princess's antechamber to announce a visitor, if, by chance, she happened to receive one. When one thinks of what the beautiful Duchesse de Maufrigneuse had been under the Restoration, one of the queens of Paris, a dazzling queen, whose luxurious existence equaled that of the richest women of fashion in London, there was something touching in the sight of her in that humble little abode in the Rue de Miromesnil, a few steps away from her splendid mansion, which no amount of fortune had enabled her to keep, and which the hammer of speculators has since demolished. The woman who thought she was scarcely well served by 30 servants, who possessed the most beautiful reception rooms in all Paris, and the loveliest little private apartments, and who made them the scene of such delightful fates, now lived in a small apartment of 5 rooms, an antechamber, dining room, salon, 1 bedchamber, and a dressing room, with 2 women servants only. Ah! She is devoted to her son, said that clever creature, Madame Despard, and devoted without ostentation, she is happy. Who would ever have believed so frivolous a woman was capable of such persistent resolution? Our good Archbishop has, consequently, greatly encouraged her, he is most kind to her, and has just induced the old Comtesse de Saxenia to pay her a visit. Let us admit a truth. One must be a queen to know how to abdicate, and to descend with dignity from a lofty position which is never wholly lost. Those only who have an inner consciousness of being nothing in themselves, show regrets in falling, or struggle, murmuring, to return to a past which can never return, a fact of which they themselves are well aware. Compelled to do without the choice exotics in the midst of which she had lived, and which set off so charmingly her whole being, for it is impossible not to compare her to a flower, the princess had wisely chosen a ground floor apartment. There she enjoyed a pretty little garden which belonged to it, a garden full of shrubs, and an always verdant turf, which brightened her peaceful retreat. She had about 12,000 francs a year, but that modest income was partly made up of an annual stipend sent her by the old Duchesse de Navarreins, paternal aunt of the young duke, and another stipend given by her mother, the Duchesse d'Uxelles, who was living on her estate in the country, where she economized as old duchesses alone know how to economize, for Arpagon is a mere novice compared to them. The princess still retained some of her past relations with the exiled royal family, and it was in her house that the marshal to whom we owe the conquest of Africa had conferences, at the time of Madame's attempt in La Vendée, with the principal leaders of legitimist opinion. So great was the obscurity in which the princess lived, and so little distrust did the government feel for her in her present distress. Beholding the approach of that terrible 40th year, the bankruptcy of love, beyond which there is so little for a woman as woman, the princess had flung herself into the kingdom of philosophy. She took to reading, she who for 16 years had felt a cordial horror for serious things. Literature and politics are today what piety and devotion once were to her sex, the last refuge of their feminine pretensions. In her late social circle it was said that Diane was writing a book. Since her transformation from a queen and beauty to a woman of intellect, the princess had contrived to make a reception in her little house a great honor which distinguished the favored person. Sheltered by her supposed occupation, she was able to deceive one of her former adorers, de Marsay, the most influential personage of the political bourgeoisie brought to the fore in July 1830. She received him sometimes in the evenings, and, occupied his attention while the marshal and a few legitimists were talking, in a low voice, in her bedroom, about the recovery of power, which could be attained only by a general cooperation of ideas, the one element of success which all conspirators overlook. It was the clever vengeance of the pretty woman, who thus inveigled the prime minister, and made him act a screen for a conspiracy against his own government. This adventure, worthy of the finest days of the Fronde, was the text of a very witty letter, in which the princess rendered to madame an account of the negotiations. The Duc de Maufrigneuse went to La Vendée, and was able to return secretly without being compromised, but not without taking part in madame's perils. The latter, however, sent him home the moment she saw that her cause was lost. Perhaps, had he remained, the eager vigilance of the young man might have foiled that treachery. However great the faults of the Duchesse de Maufrigneuse may have seemed in the eyes of the bourgeoisie, the behavior of her son on this occasion certainly effaced them in the eyes of the aristocracy. There was great nobility and grandeur in thus risking her only son, and the heir of an historic name. Some persons are said to intentionally cover the faults of their private life by public services, and vice versa, but the Princesse de Cadignan made no such calculation. Possibly those who apparently so conduct themselves make none. Events count for much in such cases. On one of the first fine days in the month of May, 1833, the Marquise d'Espard and the princess were turning about, one could hardly call it walking, in the single path which wound round the grass plot in the garden, about 2:30 in the afternoon, just as the sun was leaving it. The rays reflected on the walls gave a warm atmosphere to the little space, which was fragrant with flowers, the gift of the Marquise. "We shall soon lose de Marsay," said the Marquise, "and with him will disappear your last hope of fortune for your son. Ever since you played him that clever trick, he has returned to his affection for you." "My son will never capitulate to the younger branch," returned the princess, "if he has to die of hunger, or I have to work with my hands to feed him. Besides, Bertha de Sanxenia has no aversion to him." "Children don't bind themselves to their parents' principles," said Madame d'Espard. "Don't let us talk about it," said the princess. "If I can't coax over the Marquise de Sanxenia, I shall marry Georges to the daughter of some iron founderer, as that little d'Escrignan did." "Did you love Victorignan?" asked the Marquise. "No," replied the princess, gravely, "Descrignan's simplicity was really only a sort of provincial silliness, which I perceived rather too late, or, if you choose, too soon." "And de Marsay?" "De Marsay played with me as if I were a doll. I was so young at the time. We never love men who pretend to teach us, they rub up all our little vanities."
"And that wretched boy who hanged himself?"
"Lucien? An Antinous and a great poet. I worshipped him in all conscience, and I might have been happy. But he was in love with a girl of the town,
and I gave him up to Madame de Serizy. If he had cared to love me, should I have given him up? What an odd thing, that you should come into collision with an Esther. She was handsomer than I, said the princess. Very soon it shall be 3 years that I have lived in solitude, she resumed, after a pause, and this tranquility has nothing painful to me about it. To you alone can I dare to say that I feel I am happy. I was surfeited with adoration, weary of pleasure, emotional on the surface of things, but conscious that emotion itself never reached my heart. I have found all the men whom I have known petty, paltry, superficial, none of them ever caused me a surprise, they had no innocence, no grandeur, no delicacy. I wish I could have met with one man able to inspire me with respect. Then are you like me, my dear? Asked the Marquise. Have you never felt the emotion of love while trying to love? Never, replied the princess, laying her hand on the arm of her friend. They turned and seated themselves on a rustic bench beneath a jasmine then coming into flower. Each had uttered one of those sayings that are solemn to women who have reached their age. Like you, resumed the princess, I have received more love than most women, but through all my many adventures, I have never found happiness. I committed great follies, but they had an object, and that object retreated as fast as I approached it. I feel today in my heart, old as it is, an innocence which has never been touched. Yes, under all my experience, lies a first love intact, just as I myself, in spite of all my losses and fatigues, feel young and beautiful. We may love and not be happy, we may be happy and never love, but to love and be happy, to unite those two